from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Did you know that a particular kind of mushroom, the Italian white truffle to be exact, costs $3,000 a pound, making it the most expensive food in the world? Or did you know that mushrooms could be used to break up and degrade oil spills? It turns out that mushrooms have surprising nutritional value too, certain medicinal properties, and have the ability to make you high or make you die. Author Eugenia Bone describes the mushroom in all of its manifestations in her new book, Mycophilia: Revelations from the Weird World of Mushrooms. She joins us next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. In family lore, author Eugenia Bone's mother went into labor after dining on truffles, and so began a lifelong affinity for mushrooms. In Eugenia Bone's family, in fact, the outdoor sport of choice was foraging, not football. And early on, she learned the difference between a morel, a death cap, and a destroying angel. Her new book is called Mycophilia: Revelations from the Weird World of Mushrooms, and it details everything from the priciest to the diciest, the delicacies along with the deadly, and the surprising contribution that the mushroom and other fungi make to the world around us. Eugenia Bone is a frequent contributor to various culinary publications. Her previous books include Italian Family Dining and Well Preserved, and she joins us this morning on Forum. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, first of all, did I say that right? We've been debating all morning about fungi versus fungi versus fungi versus fungi, and the answer is?
Well, they're all right, but the most of the mycologists, who I guess are like the cool guys in the field, they say fungi.
Okay.
So I do
right.
too.
All right. So we'll use that as our operative word for the next hour. I want to ask you first, actually, just about what that is, because one of the many things I learned in the book is that fungi is not a plant. So what are mushrooms exactly? What do they constitute?
Mushrooms are the fruiting body of fungi. So you've seen fungi before.
Fruit of the fungi.
Yes. You've seen fungi before, like when you kick open a rotten log, that white cotton candy-like stuff, that is fungi. The fruiting body is like a flower or a fruit. It's the organ of sexual reproduction. Here's the analogy. A mushroom is like the apple, and the fungus is like the apple tree.
And there are a million or more different kinds of mushrooms in particular. Is that right?
No,
or fungi?
No. It's fungi, yes, okay. Because yeasts are fungi. Molds are fungi. And there's lots and lots of different kinds of expressions of fungi in nature. But there's a bunch of them that produce these macro fruiting bodies, fruiting structures, you know, sexual structures that you can actually see. Molds, you don't see the fruit that produces the spore.
You begin the book by talking about how basically your interest in this was venal, that you love mushrooms, but you didn't like paying for them. How did that begin for you? What was it that sort of drew you out in the search of the great mushroom?
Well, I love the wild mushroom to eat, but I also love the hunt. It was just exciting, and it was kind of a way to get free food. It was a little bit of a treasure hunt because they have value, and also being in nature was exciting and fun. But I don't like paying for them, and I didn't like these sort of small, dried-out-looking samples that I'd see in my markets. So I wanted to hunt mushrooms, and I wanted to know more. I wanted to find more different varieties of species. So I started to study the biology just to find out why they grew where. But then I fell into this vortex because the biology was so weird. And then I started to meet mushroom enthusiasts, and they were so kooky and unusual that it became an obsession beyond just eating.
And is the obsession all focused on mushrooms you find in the wild? Are the ones that sort of draw people in the most, the morel and the truffle and all the rest, are they all out there somewhere? It's not what you can just go harvest in a commercial entity?
Well, they're like the starter mushrooms, I think. You know, you get excited about morels and you get excited about truffles. But then I think as I got more passionate, and certainly I see this in other mushroom enthusiasts. You know, you can get pretty excited about a crust growing on a piece of wood. So it, I think with knowledge comes a greater, for me, came a greater appreciation of those maybe less sexy expressions of fungi in nature.
Eugenia Bone is our guest. Her new book, Mycophilia, Revelations from the Weird World of Mushrooms. Tell us something about their nutritional value, because we used to think the mushrooms were pretty worthless nutritionally.
Yes.
Now there's a different view. What is it that they offer?
Well, mushrooms, they are mostly water. So that's where that view of mushrooms not having any nutritional content comes from. But it turns out that mushrooms have a very high quality protein in them, and better than beans, in fact. Mushrooms are a source of a number of interesting minerals and vitamins, including B12, which is they're the only non-animal source of B12. And when you irradiate mushrooms, like put them on a tanning bed, for example, the ultraviolet light converts a hormone in the mushroom into vitamin D2. And that's also the only non-animal source of vitamin D2, which is a good vitamin we all need. So they're also a great source of fiber, very low calorie, low fat, very low sodium. But they're as satisfying to eat as beef because of that high quality protein.
And you also write that they do something that works in a complementary fashion with other food. Is that right? That they sort of work to boost the value of other food?
Yes. I read a few studies about that, and it's kind of cool. Like some classic recipes, say mushroom barley soup, is a good example of copacetic foods that in combination are extremely nutritional and very good for you. So in that's an example.
So to go back to your apple analogy, so it's a mushroom a day? I mean, is that kind of benefit?
Well, you'd have to eat – look. For a woman my age to get enough protein from mushrooms, I'd have to eat a lot of mushrooms, maybe much more than I'd want to eat. But they are a healthy, low-cal food, and they're a great substitute for a red meat if you're trying to lose weight.
Well, let's pursue that for a moment, because you reference in the book that you went on this – I can't call it the mushroom diet. But if you called it the mushroom diet, it would be the most emailed article in the New York Times, right? So, but you did something like that, and you lost weight. So what
yes.
did you do?
Well, it's based on a study that was done that showed – two things. One is if mushrooms replaced meat in recipes, the recipes would be otherwise the same. So like sloppy joes or, you know, spaghetti alla bolognese or something. If mushrooms replace the meat, then not only do you take in less calories, which is obvious, you know, but you feel just as full, so you don't snack, which is a kind of key aspect of mushrooms that one doesn't necessarily, you know, think of or consider. I did it for a few weeks and actually saw a few pounds fall off. It was without really any effort and not ever feeling denied.
And is this true across the mushroom varieties? I mean, is one as good as the other for its weight loss propensity or its nutritional value?
Yes. There's some variables in different mushrooms in terms of, you know, what – how much iron and things like that that are in them. But in general, they're across the board, a good food to eat. They're just a different category of food altogether. I mean, that's the thing that people don't realize, that they're not plants. They're not meat. They're somewhere – they're a whole other category. So to look at it that way and include it into your diet as a unique food stuff, I think is worthwhile and delicious.
We'll come back, no doubt, and we'll open up our phone lines in a bit and hear more about all of those possibilities. But let's also talk for a moment about the dark side of mushrooms. I love these names, the destroying angel, the death cap. How potentially lethal are mushrooms for those who go out and hunt and here in Northern California or anywhere else? How wary do you really need to be?
Well, I think it's as important to know the few mushrooms that are deadly as it is to know the few mushrooms that are spectacularly delicious. And they're not hard to identify. You learn them just like you learn any other mushroom. The when mycologists talk about poisoning, that's a wide category. It includes mushrooms that are inebriators or psychedelics, for example. That's a type of poisoning that falls into that category. It also includes a mushroom that just gives you a little diarrhea, you know, or a little GI upset. It's not that big a deal. And it includes things like the Amanita phalloides, which basically takes out your liver in about 4 days or less.
And how common are those? What should you watch for if you're going out this weekend? Or maybe this is too late. I don't know when mushroom hunting season actually is, to tell you the truth. But what should you watch for?
Well, I don't want to advise people, you know, have them hear what I say and go, oh, that sounds like it's not an Amanita. I think I'll put it in a soup. Yeah. It's the way to learn mushrooms is to learn them with a mycologist, somebody who knows. So that's just a matter of going on a foray with your local mycological society, of which there are many in this part of the country, and they're very good. You need to learn how to identify it and stay away from it.
So rule number one, don't go hunting mushrooms until you know what you're doing.
Don't go eating mushrooms until you know what you're doing. Yeah. But the truth is once you sort of get into it or put a little energy into it, telling the difference between two mushrooms is like telling the difference between an apple and an artichoke. They really are significantly different from each other.
Except one of the ones that you describe is the false morel, which
yes.
I guess looks like – so it's more similar. You're pointing to the cover of your book here.
Yes,
and you're
that lower one is the false morel, Gyromitra.
Okay. So in that case, it does resemble something that's attractive. And here's what I found fascinating that you wrote about. These are the ones that can sort of make – they're sort of like a narcotic. They make you fall asleep. Is that right, the false morel?
No, that's the Amanita muscaria, the red one with the white dots on it. You know, it's sort of the iconic mushroom. You see it in all sorts of images and culture.
But okay, so I've you can already tell I haven't gone out with my local mycological society. But
that was a good idea.
What I found fascinating you write about is that there is this mushroom that has this sort of semi-dangerous propensity, but surveys of people who are mushroom aficionados still want to try it.
Oh, I know what you're referring to.
And you actually wanted to try it and
did, which
I found remarkable.
All right. So what you're right on with the Gyromitra. There are people who eat it. It has a chemical in it that's toxic that is heat labile, so you can cook it and that toxicity will be burned off and some people eat it. But it's risky because you don't know how long to boil it off. The same technique is used for the Amanita muscaria, which is a red mushroom with the white dots. You can boil it, and the ibotenic acid in it, that is a neurotoxin, will sort of disappear into the atmosphere. You're not supposed to put your face over the boiling water, by the way. And then you can cook them up and eat them. But it's risky because there's just no guidelines, and there's just a lot of difference between different specimens within the same species.
So what was the one that you tried and that, I mean, I just am curious about why you would try it and what that experience was like.
Well, there's a little bit of a macho thing about eating these mushrooms, and I don't recommend it, but I was following that path. You know, I was into it and hanging out with the mycologists. So there are some guys that I know, and they were collecting the Amanita muscaria, the red mushroom with the white dots, and they were planning to eat it. And I said, well, I want to try it too. If you guys are doing it, then I want to do it. So that may sound stupid. Maybe it was. That's why I don't recommend other people do it, but I did it. We boiled the mushroom, then sauteed it. It was delicious, and I promptly fell asleep. I mean, a coma-like sleep. Woke up 2 hours later with one shoe on. And I feel like I'm lucky I didn't wake up in a ditch.
Eugenia Bone, mycophilia. I guess that's the definition, perhaps, of that. Revelations from the weird world of mushrooms. Well, this brings us to the next thing I wanted to talk about, which is you read your book and you think, you know, this is interesting, but these people are kind of nutty. I mean, there is this kind of, yeah, sure, I'll try that, and this obsessive hunt for the ultimate mushroom.
It's totally the case. I mean, it really is a very obsessed crowd, in a good way. I mean, they're interested in nature. In fact, if it weren't for mushroom enthusiasts' fascination and interest in nature, I think we would fall somewhere in an unfortunate category between the people who hunt for treasure ships and the guy who works the beaches in Fort Lauderdale with a metal detector.
Right.
It's a community that is like-minded, but also made up of a lot of solo travelers. You know, they're folks that commune with the woods, ultimately.
You tell a story about how some people, when they go out, and if they've had success in finding whatever mushroom they're pursuing, that they'll wear the same clothes, that they're sort of lucky clothes. And so I don't know any other word other than a sort of obsessive pursuit, but...
Yeah, there's also kind of a magical thing that goes on. I mean... I think part of that is because with mushroom hunting, in order for you to be successful, one has to experience a kind of pattern recognition.
Hmm.
So what happens is you're wandering in the woods looking for morel mushrooms, for example, which are in season now, and you see nothing and nothing and nothing. And then you see one by luck. And then you see thousands. And it's this revelation. It's this wonderful reveal from the forest to you. It's like a gift. I'm showing myself to you. And it's a real turn on. It's very exciting. I mean, honestly, I'm getting goosebumps. Is that totally strange? But the feeling is such a high. It's so exciting and so beautiful and graceful at the same time.
Eugenia Bone, the new book, Mycophilia, Revelations from the Weird World of Mushrooms. We're going to open our phone lines a little bit early. If you have a question for Eugenia Bone about the pursuit of the ultimate mushroom, you can join us now or share your own story about hunting them, eating them, cooking them. You can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org, or you can go to our Facebook page and post your question or observation there. Where should you go about beginning to get smart about this, beginning to even know where to look?
I think the best thing to do is join your local mycological society, because what they'll do is take you on walks, on forays with experts who will say, these are the mushrooms that are growing in your region. These are the ones you don't want to eat. These are the ones you do want to eat. And you'll see the mushroom in its environment, which is a lot more illustrative than seeing a photo.
Are there general, rules like you go to the forest, you go in a certain time of year? I mean, are there some basic sort of mushroom 101s that you can share?
Well, for every area of the country, it's different. But the rainy season in California is when most of your mushrooms come up, and the real challenge is to find woods that you're allowed to tromp around in and not be trespassing. So if you join your local mycological society, which is usually incredibly inexpensive, they're not very fancy groups, although San Francisco Mycological Society has 850 members. It's a very large group. They'll take you on the walks. You'll learn where the mushrooms are growing in your region, in your immediate region, and they'll explain, they'll answer your questions, really.
Let's spend a moment on cost. You have this one astonishing statistic that Italian white truffles cost $3,000 a pound?
Wholesale this past season, yeah. That's the most expensive food in the world.
And how is that, I guess I haven't sampled, so I don't know, but why would one do that? what would make it that worthy? What would make it so that those restaurants have to lock them up in a safe at night?
They're totally delicious. They are so delicious and so erotic. The white truffle evolved to, it's an underground mushroom. It evolved to attract different truffles evolved to attract mammals to dig them up and disperse their spore. The white truffle has evolved with the swine. The pig smells the white truffle and digs it up. So we have a lot of similarities to swine and are equally excited by the white truffle. It's evolved to excite us.
And it's supposed to actually be an aphrodisiac, right? Or is that just myth?
That's one of those things that, you know, it has these steroids and stuff that are similar or imitative of certain hormones and steroids in human bodies. But it does attract us. It's attracting us because it wants us to disperse its spore, you know, to dig it up and move it around. Whether you can actually soften up a victim with it, I just I don't know. I think Marquis de Sade, tried it, though.
Ooh, that's really that's beyond scary. Stephanie is up with our first call this morning on forum. Stephanie, go ahead. You're on with Eugenia Bone.
Hi. Yes. Under the guidance of Dr. Dennis Desjardins at San Francisco State, and I'm doing an all species inventory of the puffballs of California. My question is, what do you know about the medicinal qualities of puffballs? It seems to be that native countries use them, but it's pieces of information to find.
We're kind of losing you, Stephanie, but I think we got the heart of your question. And you have a whole chapter about the medicinal qualities of various kinds of mushrooms.
Yeah, like the folk uses of different mushrooms that puffballs were used as what is it called? Septic? You know, to stop blood from flowing out of wounds. I can't think offhand of any concurrent uses of puffballs in medicinal practices or any studies that I'm aware of utilizing puffballs or the kind of active ingredients in them. But definitely in traditional cultures, indigenous cultures in the United States, they were used to help stop bleeding and wounds. You know, you'd put the puffball on your cut and it would absorb.
And most of the other medicinal qualities and claims still from a Western medicine standpoint have not been adequately clinically tested. Is that right?
Yes. It's just it's a difficult thing because the mushrooms are used in the traditional Chinese medicine, but they're also used in conjunction with other therapies like acupuncture. And also you have to remember that in Chinese medicine, the impetus is toward staying healthy versus the Western modern approach, which is where the emphasis is on killing disease. So the trials that are going down to figure out how sort of polysaccharides and mushrooms, which are like the most interesting aspect, I guess, and might be effective in medicines are ongoing. There are some really incredible medicines that are derived from mushrooms, like cyclosporine, which is a medicine that you take if you've had an organ transplant. It helps you from rejecting the organ. And that comes from – it's synthesized from or originates in a mushroom called the a cordyceps mushroom that is a parasite of the scarab beetle. So it's kind of – that's actually a cool little story because here you have a situation where the medicine that gives people a second chance at life – who have had an organ transplant, comes from a mushroom that is the parasite of the ancient Egyptian symbol of rebirth.
Eugenia Bone, Mycophilia, Revelations from the Weird World of Mushrooms, our topic this hour on Forum. We have to take a short break. When we come back, we'll get to the rest of your calls. Our phone lines are full, but we'll get through as many as we can over the next half hour. We'll talk more about some of the medicinal effects and potentials for mushrooms, as well as the psychedelic effect. I'll ask Eugenia Bone about her own experience with that, and we'll get to all of your questions, which right now range from recipes for morels to concentrations of heavy metals to pronunciations. We'll get through all of that, I promise, in the rest of our program. 866-733-6786 is the number, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or post your question on our Facebook page. Back with more in just a moment. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Mushrooms are our topic this hour. Eugenia Bone, our guest, her book, Mycophilia, Revelations from the Weird World of Mushrooms. And your calls are next. Let's go to Maria first in Mountain View. Maria, go ahead.
Good morning. It's a pleasure talking to you. On Sundays, my grandparents and basically the whole family would go mushroom hunting in May or whenever the warmer rains came. And with morels, my grandmother cooked them like Wiener Schnitzel. That means you cut the morel, let's say, in half, put them over flour, an egg bath, and then breadcrumbs. And it was the most divine dish.
Sounds like a memory that's still very much at your core in the way in which you look back on your childhood.
Yes, and I have never been able to reproduce it. But of course, the morels you find in the market are nothing like I remember.
And where did you find those? Where was
that? In Hungary.
Uh-huh. All right. Thank you. Yeah,
sorry.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Maria.
I just wanted to ask the lady if by any chance she knows why the red mushroom with the white dots is such a pervasive symbol in fairy tales.
Hmm. Okay. All right. Thanks, Maria. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. A lot of people have a lot of different ideas about how to answer that. One possibility is in Siberia, there is some reindeer herding tribes that use the mushroom for inebriation, but also in shamanistic practice and in medicinal practice. And there's been ongoing reports about this. These tribes and this and the use of this mushroom for a very long time, for hundreds, well, 150 years, I guess. And some people think that the Santa Claus story is a proxy for the Amanita inebriator, where the Amanita muscaria, the red mushroom with the white dots, is a proxy for Santa himself. That the presents under the Christmas tree is a proxy for the mushroom, which is found underneath the pine tree. That's its symbiotic partner.
Now you're just really going too far.
I'm sorry.
Santa Claus
I didn't make
as
that
a
up,
mushroom.
Yeah. Oh, yes. But so I think that – and then the flying reindeer that comes out of that tribe. It goes on. But so it just – you know, I think the fact that people know it's an inebriator – historically, and that's led to part of its – and it's distinctive too. Yeah.
Let's come back to – I'm curious about Maria's other question, that she's never been able to replicate that childhood recipe that her grandmother made. Do you have a favorite for how you cook morels in the way she was describing?
The way she's describing morels is very popular, and I know people who love to eat them that way. I've also heard about people stuffing them with crab and smoking them on mesquite and all kinds of recipes, and it seems like everyone's passionate about their own. For me, we ate them with pasta because my father is an Italian cook, and so that's – we always ate mushrooms with pasta, or ate morels with protein. Mushrooms in general are fantastic cooked with other proteins.
Some cooking questions or shopping questions rather from Prima in Oakland, who writes, very nifty program. I have two health-related questions for you. The Asian foods aisle at Berkeley Bowl has lots of dried mushrooms. Would these have the same nutritional benefits as non-dried mushrooms?
Yes. The only difference between a dried mushroom and a fresh mushroom is the dried one doesn't have the water in it. So but you have to rehydrate them in order to make them edible. Yes, they do have the same nutritional value.
And I know you don't want to be dispensing too much medicinal advice, but she also asked, my naturopath once told me that since I'm allergic to mold, I shouldn't ever eat mushrooms. Any evidence for that?
I just don't know. I mean, there isn't an allergy to mold in itself has got a lot of mysteries to it because with every breath you take, you breathe in up to 10 fungal spores. We've evolved with fungi in our respiratory system and in our bodies, and we've evolved an immune system to deal with it, to live with all of these fungal spores. So folks whose immune system is rejecting that and is having a hard time with it, you know, it's not that unique. A lot of people seem to suffer from it, but it's a condition that has its own set of challenges. I feel sorry for the emailer. That's a difficult position to be in because they're everywhere.
And let's get back to more of our calls. Judy in Palo Alto has a question. Judy, go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thank you for the program. I love eating morels, and I find it very difficult to get the sand and the grit out of them. And after you've cooked them and you're dying to eat them and you bite down on some grit, it's very unpleasant.
Yes. Well, a lot of people say don't soak mushrooms, but you should soak morels. You get them into some warm water and swish away. You just swish, swish, swish to try to loosen that sand out of all those little honeycombed features. If your morels, if you have reason to think they might be a little wormy, you can put salt in the water and it'll draw out the critters. But in contrast to the usual advice about soaking mushrooms, in the case of morels, go for it.
Judy, thank you very much.
Okay, Judy, thanks for the call. Paul is next in Santa Rosa. Paul, go ahead.
Hi. I really enjoy doing wild mushroom hunting in Europe, but I'd like to have Eugenie address a couple issues before people start consuming large quantities of mushrooms in their diet. The first is the tendency of mushrooms to concentrate heavy metals. I've read and done studies looking at the concentrations of lead for mushrooms collected anywhere near roads where leaded gasoline has been used, that it's about 50-fold increase in the concentrations of lead compared to mushrooms collected in deep forest areas. And the second is that for certain mushrooms like morels, the concentration of aflatoxins in them, which if Eugenie could address concerns about just how many mushrooms the average person should consume.
Okay. Paul, thanks for the questions. Heavy metals first.
Mushrooms concentrate heavy metals.
What does that mean, concentrate
heavy
metals? They take them in?
Yes. The mycelium will move those metals along into the mushroom. And so, in fact, a mushroom, if you did a study on a mushroom and you found large quantities of lead in it, there will be more in the mushroom than in the surrounding soil. So
actually, just to touch on briefly, is part of what's interesting about their potential power to deal with certain environmental problems. After the oil spill, there was this thought that mushrooms actually, and is it that same ability that they can kind of soak things up?
Well, in the case of the heavy metals, they do. In the case of oil, the mycelium actually can degrade the oil. It can break down a fungi can break down anything that's carbon-based. But a metal is an element, so that can't be broken down. And the mushrooms definitely are capable of concentrating that metal. And that's a problem for eating. So where you pick a mushroom matters. In the East, we have morels that grow under dying apple trees, so we go to old orchards. However, in the 50s and 60s, there was a practice of spraying arsenic-lead pesticides on the trees. There's arsenic-lead pesticides in the soil, and the morels seem to concentrate it. So there really is a responsibility to sort of know where you're picking them, because The mushroom is what it eats.
And Paul, if you would, you're still with us on the line. Repeat your second question, please.
Issues with aflatoxins in certain mushrooms like morels. I've read several studies in Sweden where they report dangerous concentrations of aflatoxins in certain mushrooms. Perhaps not an issue if you have one or two, but you start going on a mushroom diet.
And can you just, I'm not clear on what, is it aflatoxins, Paul? Is it?
Aflatoxins.
Okay. Can you describe what those are and what concern there should be?
I can't remember what they are. I know I wrote about them in my book, but to be honest with you, I haven't thought about them in quite a while. The concentrations, as I recall, are not, in most cases, it's not something that is extreme enough to cause illness, that there's those same conditions in other foods. It's kind of a relative issue. If somebody is going to eat nothing but mushrooms, aflatoxins are a concern, but so is malnutrition, to be honest with you. I mean, if you eat nothing but mushrooms for weeks on end, there's any number of problems that you might encounter.
Paul, we'll see if we can find out more about that. But thanks for the question. Let's move on to Jim, who joins us from Novato. Jim, go ahead.
Yes, I came out from Buffalo, New York. I didn't even like mushrooms. And in 1978, an Italian friend who grew up in San Francisco took me up north to go mushroom hunting. And it was an amazing experience. We were going for boletes, which is the king of the mushroom. And we're in the woods up there, and it's foggy, and we could hear the sounds of men and talking to each other in Italian. We couldn't see them, but I thought, I'm way out of my element here. But I became totally passionate for it, and I've been mushroom hunting ever since, and I have found chanterelles, and I'm not going to. And then the one downside that I have seen over the past few years in a state park north of California that I'm not going to, north of San Francisco, that I won't mention, the mushroom pickers have really caused some severe litter and damage to the area around a particular campground, which I found kind of appalling. But other than that, it's been a magnificent experience, and I've got a few spots like others that your favorite spot that you go to. And when you first see one of those in the early morning light, you know you're going to get at least two, three, maybe a dozen. It's a great feeling, and it's definitely addicting.
Jim, mm-hmm. Thanks. Thanks for the story. Jim touches on something that you also write about somewhat in the book, which is there's sometimes this sort of conflict among mushroom hunters, those who do it commercially, those who are out for fun, and it's almost like some of the stories you sometimes read about migrant workers and prejudice against those who are from other ethnicities. Describe that part of the story that Jim was alluding to.
Well, there's a group of about 1,000 circuit pickers, and these are the people that collect the wild mushrooms that are showing up in most of your restaurants and markets. And they are in business to collect mushrooms. They camp in designated campsites, and they will hunt. They'll check their patches that they know year after year. They follow the mushroom bloom as it occurs annually for about 9 months or 10 months out of the year. The problem is sometimes there's different groups have different attitudes toward the forest. People that live in an area might what I've seen and what I've reported on is that they will become discouraged and unhappy when a migrant group comes through and they're just going to the forest to collect mushrooms and then get out of there, and they don't have the same sort of connection to the forest, and that can lead to conflict. And misunderstandings, sometimes violent ones. But it's just always the case when people have a different sets of values about the place where they are.
It's fascinating. I mean, I never would have thought that there would have been that mushroom hunting would be a source of conflict and tension. But it's because in part of what you write about quite a lot in the book, which is that it's, for many people, it's symbolic of a particular connection to the environment, to the forest, and all the rest.
Well, also, it's the largest cash business in the United States. So there's a lot of people that are there to make a living.
Say more about that. What makes it when you say it's the largest cash business, what does that
largest
actually mean?
Largest legal cash business. That's an estimated statement that I've heard from the Forest Service, numerous sources. Well, in the 90s, it was in the high hundreds of millions of dollars, the trade in wild mushrooms. It's come down now to around maybe $300 million or the low hundreds of millions of dollars a year.
So can you make a lot of money as a mushroom hunter?
Well, you know, I don't think you make enough money to pay taxes. I mean, it's not like being a banker or something. You don't really make that much money, but it's a lifestyle thing too. And for people that have maybe language issues, you know, or other reasons that they just like being out in the woods. That's the way they want to make a living. It's worth it, you know. It's worth the decline in income.
Let's go to Celeste next in San Francisco. Celeste, go ahead.
Hi. I'm talking about psilocybin mushrooms. They're legal in the United States, but I've actually heard that there have been studies recently that discuss the possibility of some psychotherapeutic benefits of this mushroom, like the psychedelic parts of it that I guess help patients who are dealing with terminal illnesses and like foreseeing the death in the near future, how they let them eat these mushrooms and kind of feel out a spiritual connection of some sort. I'm wondering what you know about that.
Celeste, thanks for the call. There's a chapter in your book that's devoted to this topic. On the medicinal part of it first, some studies, right, with psilocybin and obsessive-compulsive disorders. So there are some scientific pursuits, as Celeste is describing, in terms of their potential medicinal effect.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, psilocybin has had a renaissance in the scientific community. I mean, after being, you know, 30 years of being a career tanker for a researcher, now more people are studying psilocybin and how it can help people with various neurological and emotional disorders. So the studies that are the most provocative or that have kind of come to conclusion, so there's papers that you can read online, would are in a few different categories. There are some studies on psilocybin and its effect, the positive effect on people with neurological disorders like OCD. And then there are studies that the listener is referring to that are really interesting, which explore how psilocybin can help people who have end-of-life or terminal anxiety and depression. It seems that when they take the psilocybin, it kind of gives them a new perspective about the reality of their own mortality and the reality that it is everyone's end result, that we're all in the same boat together. And it seems to really help them. And as a result, it helps families too.
Describe your own experience. You decided in the end that you were curious enough about the psychedelic effect, if that's even the right word, I'm not sure it is, about taking that kind of mushroom. What did you get from that experience? What did you take, first of all, and what did you learn?
Well, first of all, I'm a middle-aged woman, you know, purse-carrying soccer mom. And so I was so nervous about it. It was ridiculous. I'm sure some of the listeners would think I'm totally silly. But I was nervous about it, and I tried to prepare, and I read everything I could. And I got some mushrooms through a mycologist because I didn't know, like, how to buy them or anything like that. You know, where do you go on the street or something? And I was very nervous about getting arrested. And, oh, the whole thing was just traumatic. And I put it off for a long time before I finally said, okay, I got to know. I got to know what it is. What it is about this blue staining mushroom that changes people's entire perspective of how they see the world. So I took a small amount and I was out in the woods and I didn't have the kind of experience that people who take large amounts have. I didn't have something that sort of I didn't lose my faculties at all. I mean, I could have gone to a cafe and ordered a coffee, although I don't think I could have read the paper. during that time, I had all of these insights about how I see myself and how I think other people see me that was very clarifying and comforting because some questions that had lingered in my mind seemed resolved. And then I went back to my hotel room and I did something that is always a little bit problematic for women my age. I took a bath. You know, I certainly can be very self-critical during bath time. And I was still on the mushroom, although I was coming down. It only lasts for about 4 hours. And I realized that my body was really healthy and a great vessel taking me through life, and that it was okay that I was aging, I was losing my looks and all that. It didn't matter. What mattered was that I was working for me, and that's a
– And that perceptance stayed with you.
Yes,
I mean, this wasn't just
this
a 24-hour moment.
No,
yeah.
No. Yeah. It was a long – to this day, I feel – I'm kind of over it, you know? I'm kind of over the wrinkles and stuff. It's, I'll tell you, it was like a little spa session, but that lasted.
And let's go next to Dale, who also has an aha moment he wants to describe. Dale, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I've experienced that moment of revelation when one finally sees a single specimen of the quarry and then discovers that they're all over the place, if you're lucky. And where I experienced that first was as an abalone diver. Anyone who's ever actually dove for abalone on the North Coast knows that until you actually see see what it is you're after. They're very highly camouflaged, and so it's pretty much a really exciting moment. I've also had I've been a member of the San Francisco Mycological Society for over 30 years, and I had the privilege a couple of years ago of going on a foray and an educational foray, I should say, with David Arora, who is recognized as one of the world's experts on mushrooms, and that was pretty exciting. Another thing about hunting mushrooms is it gives one the opportunity to have an excuse for being out in the woods in the rain and the fog when normally people wouldn't be out there, and have it be a really enjoyable experience.
Dale, I'm going to hold you there because we're short on time and we have other callers. But thanks for adding that in. And that is part of what you described, too, that it's for you it becomes this deeper connection to how all of nature works.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's very, very fulfilling.
We should get on the line now some information about a mushroom festival. It's the Morgan Hill Mushroom Mardi Gras Festival, which happens to be coming up this weekend. Is that right? Joining us now, Sunday Minnick, who is the director of the event. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, well, just give us a quick little preview, please, of what's happening in Morgan Hill, the Mushroom Mardi Gras Festival in Morgan Hill.
Yes, it's our 33rd annual. It's free admission, and it's a family fun festival. It focuses on the mushroom educational aspect of it, as well as gourmet mushroom dishes and cooking demonstration stage. And we also have arts and crafts, a huge kids area with games, rides, and entertainment, two stages of live entertainment. So it's a lot of fun. We hope everybody comes out and visits us. It's free admission, free parking, 10 to 7 on Saturday and 10 to 6 on Sunday.
And is Morgan Hill a big mushroom hunting area on Morgan Hill itself?
Yeah, Morgan Hill is the mushroom capital of the U.S. in the western western states.
All right. Thanks very much. Glad to hear about it. I had no idea that Morgan Hill was the mushroom capital of the western states. Thanks very much, Sunday Minnick. Let's get in one more call from Ron in Kensington. Ron, go ahead.
Good morning. So I wanted to comment on two things about other users of the woods. I've been a forager for more than 40 years, and I will say one thing, I have much greater appreciation and respect for logging as something that's consonant with the overall health of the woods and good mushroom hunting. The other thing is you really have to look out these days for marijuana growers. I like to get out in some of the more remote areas, and it's really getting a little dangerous at times.
Ron, thanks. Interesting point. Have you run into that, Eugenie?
Yes, yes. There's a threat to mushroom hunters. You know, you stumble upon some hidden little pot farm in the woods, and, you know, it could be dangerous for sure.
Couple of emails. Let's try to get through just a few more before we have to bring our program to a close. Harriet writes in, is there an expiration period for dried mushrooms like porcinis if one has purchased them in a sealed packet? The packets have no expiration dates printed on them.
Yeah, dried mushrooms will fade over time. The flavor will fade, and you can extend it by throwing those dried mushrooms in the freezer. Like any dried product, they will fade over time. It's good to eat them, you know, in the first year. That said, I have some fine vintages of dried mushrooms that are perfectly delicious.
Dean writes in, I'm in Marin County and wondering where morels grow best. In what forest environment do they prosper? Under what trees? I know you probably don't have a particular location to point people to, but are there some general rules about where you find them most?
Yes. They are typically found under in the east, dying apples and dying elm. They can be found under tulip trees, otherwise known as tulip poplars, but tulip trees, under sycamore trees. I'm going morel hunting tomorrow morning in the Crystal Basin, and that's fir tree country. Hopefully I'll find them. I have a feeling that it's going to snow. It's going to be a little on the chilly side. But they're morels. What mycologists say about morels is they grow wherever they want to. They are extremely opportunistic. I mean, there's something called a landscape morel. So every time I have to go to a hospital or a courthouse, I always look in the – and it's springtime. I always look in the landscaping on the wood chips because there are morels grow there as well. I mean, morels grow in the middle of a gravel driveway. They grow wherever they want to. But in general, depending on what area you're in, the best thing to do is to hook up with your local mycological society because they'll show you the spots.
Just have a moment left, and I don't want to get all sort of phonally deep and meaningful about how mushrooms can save the world and all of that. But you write in the end about how it has given you this sort of deeper appreciation of certain things about life, and among other things that you write that everything is plural. Tell me what that means and what you in the end have gained from this sort of lifelong for you pursuit of mushrooms.
Well, I think that ultimately the avenue was when mushrooms are the macro fruiting mat. That's the thing you see. But fungi are microscopic. When I realized that there was this huge microscopic community, bacterial and fungal and other critters in nature that were key to the successful life of all living things on the planet, it really changed my perspective. And I realized that just as the plant-fungi relationship is an ancient symbiotic pluralism, so too in us the bacterial and animal relationship is an ancient and symbiotic pluralism. So then you start thinking about it, and I came to realize that nothing in life is expressed as a single entity, that we're all one, and we're all multiple beings. I am we.
Eugenia Bone, the book Mycophilia, Revelations from the Weird World of Mushrooms. Thanks so much for being on our program. Really a pleasure.
Thank you.
Forum is produced by Katrina Schwartz and Judy Campbell. Dan Zoll is our senior editor. Danny Bringer, our engineer. Raul Ramirez, our executive producer. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.